All right, let's go ahead and open up to John 4. I wasn't planning on spending 2 weeks on the Samaritans, the background of the Samaritans, but I had a whole bunch of responses and questions, and we're looking for clarification. So I thought we would just go through in a little more detail, and we didn't really talk about it in the New Testament, what we call the New Testament, the Gospel accounts, Acts period, that kind of thing. So we'll expand it and go look at that. So the first couple slides are going to just basically review, bringing out a little more detail on the Samaritans, because if we understand better who the Samaritans are in Jesus' day, we'll better understand the Samaritan woman and what Jesus is trying to convey to her. So we're going to take a look at that and the Old Testament background, that's what we kind of raced through last week and took a look at this. So I'm not going to go into every detail, but I just wanted to bring it at least back to mind because it's going to be important when we get into the gospel accounts in Acts. We're not going to turn to 1 Kings 12. And if I say anything about Corinthians, you'll know it's Kings. I know we're not going to do anything in Corinthians tonight. But in 1 Kings 12, that's right after the reigns of David, and maybe we should go ahead and take a look at our timeline here. Here's the timeline. There's no dispensation of grace. This is God's prophetic program with Israel. This goes 950, goes all the way back to just after the reigns of David and Solomon, way over here. And that nation splits into two nations. And we looked at some of the details of that last week. You had the 10 tribes in the more northeastern and northwestern area. They went up and formed their own kingdom. The nation divided what's called the Northern Kingdom. Judah, which includes Jerusalem and Benjamin, made up the Southern Kingdom. So it splits into two kingdoms just before, right around the second course of punishment. That's actually, according to Leviticus 26, that's one of the key things with that second course of punishment. He's going to break the pride of their power. And that brings around second course of punishment. So you have the Northern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom, once you get into the prophets, can be called Israel. That's a little confusing because sometimes Israel means the whole united nation. As a matter of fact, probably when we say it, we mean the whole united nation. But once you get to the division, Israel oftentimes refers just to the Northern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom is also called Ephraim and Samaria. And they divided under Jeroboam, that was their first king, and he led them into severe idolatry at the split of the kingdom here. And that continued for a number of years, for another 200 plus years, until the Babylonian captivity. So when we get after the division of the country, this division here, there's Israelites in the land, we'll call it Samaria, Israel, the Northern Kingdom, Israelites in the land of the Northern Kingdom, and they joined together with Jeroboam in his rebelliousness against God, and they became idolatrous. Jeroboam introduced that idolatry, and for the next 200 plus years, in spite of the fact of God working them in the second, third, and part of the fourth course of punishment, calling them back to himself, instead, the Israelites in the Northern Kingdom followed in Jeroboam's footsteps and actually got worse in their rebelliousness and increased in their idolatrousness, even went beyond what Jeroboam did. And that characterized this 200 to 300 years in between the division and when God finally removes them from the land because they're so rebellious. So these are, during this time, there's Israelites in Samaria. Okay, keep that in mind. What we could call Israelites, Samarians. They're Israelites who live in Samaria. Just like we might refer to someone in Chicago as Chicagoan. But there's also in this time frame, you have Israelites who are going to be left behind. Israelites during this time, these 200 or 300 years, that believe in the Lord. and that that don't participate in this idolatrous practice. And they're going to be the outcasts because they reject the ruling group's idolatry. They become the outcasts of society. They're what we would call the believing remnant of Israel. So during this time, from Jeroboam on, they get more and more, the nation, the northern kingdom as a whole, gets more and more entrenched in idolatry, but there is a small part of the population that still adheres to the one true God, the Lord Jehovah God of Israel, what we would call that believing remnant of Israel. So keep that in mind. And it's important to see now. Let's go now to 2 Kings 17. And let's just, we looked at this last week, so we're only, we almost went through the whole chapter last week. We're only going to look at this one verse here. Remember, the kingdom divides here at the second course of punishment. It follows in Jeroboam's the bulk of the nation follows in Jeroboam's idolatry until the Lord can't take it anymore, and he's going to remove them from the land, the idolatrous Israelites from the land. But the thing to keep in mind is during this time, there was also a believing remnant of Israel who rejected the idolatry. There's always a believing, you know, when the prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, when they talk, there's always a believing remnant. There's a few who do stay loyal to the Lord, faithful to the Lord, and don't go off into idolatry. So there's two groups in Samaria at this time. There's the idolatrous Israel. That's the bulk. That's the strong part. That's the society as a whole. And God's going to carry them off in the captivity. Then they're going to leave behind the poor and the outcast, the ones that can't offer anything, in the land. And the question is, why are they poor and outcast? Well, it's because they rejected the idolatry of the society as a whole, and they were outcast, persecuted. You know, the believing remnant's always persecuted throughout the Old Testament and into the new, into the gospel accounts in Acts. So you have two groups here. You have the idolatrous Israelites, that's the bulk of the nation, the leaders, the ones who are in control, the people running the place. But then you have another group of Israelites that's the believing remnant of Israel. And because they don't participate in the ruling part of the nation, they're persecuted, they're outcast, they're set aside, and they're poor and all that. And so you got those two groups in the nation from about 950 BC to 722 when that Assyrian captivity comes. So now the Assyrian captivity comes, and let's just pick it up. We're only going to read verse 29. 2 Kings 17:29. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own. Now notice it says every nation. He's not talking here about the Israelites. He's talking about every nation that that Assyria brought in. Remember, we read about that. Once Assyria came and took away the bulk of the idolatrous nation, the idolatrous Israelites, he sent in Gentiles to rule in his stead, pagan Gentiles with their own idolatry, their own gods, their own worship system. They ended up mixing in. They wanted to be okay with the God in the land. They threw the Lord in their paganism and worshiped in that way, just a mishmash of all different kind of idolatries. And the idolatrous Israelites, though, have been carried off. Now, with that in mind, let's finish reading chapter 29. So Assyria brings from five nations, brings in pagan Gentiles to rule the land of Samaria on their behalf. Because they took away the rulers, the idolatrous Israelites were ruling the place. God had them carried off by the Assyrians. And so the Assyrians brought in Gentiles to rule the nation in their stead, to rule the people that remained in the nation. Those poor outcasts who were left behind, that I explained earlier, were mostly that believing remnant of Israel. And they stayed in the land. Now, verse 29, howbeit every nation, so these Gentile nations come in and they made gods of their own, and put them in the places, in the houses of the high places, which the Samaritans had made. So now they come in, the idolatrous Israelites have been carried off. Those are the Samaritans in this passage, the ones who live in Samaria, and they've been carried off. And how do we know they've been carried off? Well, that's the whole point of the Assyrian captivity. God removed the idolatry of the Israelites from the land. And the Gentiles came in and used their altars and used their houses of worship on the hilltops because they were no longer there. They were empty. So they just came and brought their gods and started worshiping on those altars. The Samaritans in this verse are not the Samaritans in John 4. The Samaritans in this verse are idolatrous Israelites, and I suggest calling them Samarians. They just lived in Samaria. They're not the Samaritans of John 4. The Samaritans here have been carried off, and they will enter, be scattered among the Gentiles out in the nations and be assimilated into them. And so they're carried off and assimilated into them. What's left in the land of the Israelites are believing Israelites. And then what is added to that are these pagan Gentiles that come in to rule the land in on behalf of Assyria. And so the Samaritans here are not the Samaritans in John 4. They're not even Israelites that are remain in the land. These are the idolatrous Israelites that God had carried off because of their idolatry in the Assyrian captivity. And they brought in Gentile, pagan Gentiles now, and they just took over their empty altars and their empty houses of worship and their hilltops and their tree groves and all that kind of stuff, because they were carried off. That's the Samaritans here. I'd suggest calling them idolatrous Israelite Samarians. It's not this to differentiate them from the group we're talking about in John 4. They're not the same thing. All right, so let's go back to our notes. So they're not the same thing. They're not the Samaritans of John 4. The outcasts and the underprivileged Israelites left behind were in that position because they didn't join into the idolatry of the northern kingdom, the leadership and the rulership of the northern kingdom. They remain loyal to the Lord. Perhaps because of some things that are spoken there, perhaps especially of the tribe of Joseph and Manasseh and Ephraim. Perhaps especially with Manasseh in particular, the tribe associated with Joseph and Manasseh. And they remained, if that's true, that's the bulk of that believing remnant that remained in the land that had been persecuted and outcast by the idolatrous Israelites that were carried off. Now they're in the land, especially remain loyal to the Lord and may have been especially of the tribe of Joseph and Manasseh. You'll see why that's important in a little bit. What remained in the land were at least some of the believing remnant of Israel at that time. And the thing to keep in mind now, they're going to disappear from view for the next 300 or 400 years. They're just outcasts. They're underprivileged. A bunch of Gentiles are going to come in and rule the nation on Assyria, and there will be other kingdoms that come along here. But at this time, Assyria on their behalf. This was the beginning of the Samaritans that are going to show up in John 4, and you're really, history isn't going to know anything about them, really see them again for 300 or 400 years. So keeping that in mind, another place some people think they see the Samaritans is in Ezra 4. So let's go to Ezra 4. Oops, went too far. Ezra 4. Ezra 4, some people think they see the Samaritans here. Remember, the Samaritans in 2 Kings 17, the Samaritans there are idolatrous Israelites, the ruling class of Israel, who were carried off in the captivity. They're gone. They're going to always be gone. They're going to be assimilated into the Gentile nations they're sent out to. And then Assyria brings in Gentiles to rule the Samaria on their behalf. So now when we pick it up here in Ezra 4, you're going to fast forward about 200 years from where we just were. The Assyrian captivity has happened about 200 years after that. Actually, this is after the Babylonian captivity. Ezra and Nehemiah, remember, are allowed to return to Jerusalem to at least partially rebuild the temple and rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And here we have Ezra. We're going to work on this temple. And let's just pick it up here, verse 1 of Ezra 4. Ezra 4, verse 1. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard... So now, first of all, notice these are the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin. Remember, Judah and Benjamin make up the southern kingdom. And heard that the children of the captivity, that's the Babylonian captivity, not the Assyrian captivity. These were the Jews carried off from the southern kingdom. Remember, they went to Babylon for 70 years, and then Babylon was conquered by Persia, and they allowed the Jews to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, rebuild the city. And so here you have now Samaria is down the way a little bit. They're looking on their mountains and they look down and or up. I guess you'd be looking up at Jerusalem, and they see now there's a bunch of Judeans rebuilding their temple. There's a competitive religious system going on down the street. And so they send these adversaries, they don't like it, they send these adversaries to Judah and Benjamin, and the idea, the implication is they're adversaries and they're going to try and trick them in some way to help them build this temple, probably with the intent of somehow sabotaging it. And if you read the rest of the account, you see that's what they're doing. They did only in a different way. So here you have these adversaries, they come. Now who are these adversaries? And some people think they're the Samaritans that go all the way back to the Assyrian captivity, but he tells you who they are right here. Look at verse 2. Then they came to Zerubbabel and the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God. Now these are Gentiles, remember, with five of their own pagan gods. Actually, there's seven, but they're grouped by nation, so five groups of gods. And then they threw in worship of the God of Israel, just for good measure. And so it's this hodgepodge of false worship, false gods, false everything. But they're not totally lying here. They did throw worship of the God of Israel into their worship system. But he's just another one of the gods, and they don't really worship him. As ye do, verse 2, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asshur, that's king of Assyria, which brought us up here. These are people that Assyria brought into the land. These are Gentiles who've been brought into the land to rule on Assyria's behalf. And that's what they're doing. They're looking up at Jerusalem. They see another worship system being built. They don't like it. They're going to try and get rid of it one way or another. And that's what they're here confronting Ezra about. So these are people, he says explicitly, these are people brought in by Assyria. These are not people who were already in the land. These are people brought in by the Assyrians, those five nations with their seven gods and their pagan worship system, false gods, idolatries, that took over the idolatrous altars and groves and high places of the idolatrous Israelites that were there before but were carried off in the Assyrian captivity. So that's what's going. These people, there's no mention of Samaritans here. These aren't Samaritans. They're only what you could call them, just like we called the Israelites in the past one that were carried off. They were idolatrous Israelites, Samarians, because they lived in Samaria. So too, these people are idolatrous Gentile Samarians. They live in Samaria. But they're not the Samaritans. They're not the ones left in the land after the Assyrian captivity. They're not the ones that are being talked about in John 4. All right, so let's go one step further then. So this isn't the beginning of that either. So the Samaritans of Jesus' day don't become clearly visible until about, if this is about, if this is about 558 BC, then it's not for another couple hundred years that these Samaritans that are being talked about in John 4 start coming on the scene. They don't appear until later, and this is between the Old Testament, the two Testaments. Remember that as part of the courses of punishment, one of the installments was that 400 years of silence between the end of what we call that Old Testament and the beginning of what's traditionally called that New Testament. That silence is broken with the ministry of John the Baptist. That 400 years of silence is when the Samaritans of John 4 start to really become visible and on the scene. And that's not going to be until quite a bit later. And you really don't notice them at all again in history until 400 BC when they erect their own temple. And they do that at Mount Gerizim. And that's about 400 BC. That's when they really become clearly on the scene. Now, these are the Samaritans. The Samaritans referred to in 2 Kings 17 were idolatrous Israelite Samaritans. They lived in Samaria. They were carried off, dispersed in the nations, absorbed into the Gentile world. Here, and then in the time of Ezra, the ones that came out looking for them were idolatrous Gentile Samaritans that the Assyrians brought in to rule the land on their behalf. Neither of them are the Samaritans of John 4. John 4, the Samaritans come on the scene of 400. They build the temple about 250, 1 to 150 BC. They develop what is called the Samaritan Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. They rejected the rest of the books of the, I say Bible here, but of course the Old Testament, because those books insisted that Jerusalem was the true place of worship. So they threw it away. You know, they did. How could they throw away so much of the Old Testament? Well, isn't that what we do today? What we do today is what they did back then. Don't be so surprised. How many times have we thrown away, and does historic Christianity teach us to throw away the parts of the Bible we don't like and just keep the parts of the Bible we like? How many times has the bulk of historic Christianity says, you know, spiritualize all that stuff about Israel, spiritualize that away, throw that all away, and now make it apply to us? We do the same thing. We, through historic Christianity, even within Protestant segments of it, have thrown away most of the Bible. It's called spiritualizing the scriptures. You throw it away. You just keep the things you like. Israel got all the curses. Spiritualize that away. We get all the blessings. And so when that takes a little of the mystery out of the Samaritans here. They're just doing what everybody does. Who doesn't take God and His Word seriously. And they threw away the parts they don't like, the parts that said the Davidic monarchy and the throne of David in Jerusalem and true worship at the temple in Jerusalem. They wanted it to be up on their Mount Gerizim and worship Him there. And so they just threw away the parts of the Bible that didn't fit that. And they kept, but they did keep the Samaritan Pentateuch, and they were very devoted to that, the five books of the law. And so they were very devoted to that. In about 120, this is where the major rift comes in. There's a little hint at the rift between the north and south, going back to when they split. A little hint at a rift between the Gentile Samaritans and the Judeans in Ezra's day. That rift is there. It's beginning to crack open. But where it bursts open and applies now to the Samaritans of John 4 really happens in 120 BC when a Judean by the name of Hyrcanus goes up, or down, I guess, from Jerusalem. It would be down to destroy the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim, and he devastated the population of the Samaritans. And This isn't the division between north and south we read about in 1 Kings 17, and it's not the rift between the Judeans and the idolatrous Gentile Samaritans we read about in Ezra 4. This is the main division that's going to carry into the Samaritans of Jesus's day. The Samaritans of John 4 were a close-knit group with minimal intermarriage. These are not the Samaritans or the Samaritans from 1 Corinthians. Yeah, I did it. I thought I'd get through the night without doing it. 1 Kings 17, the Gentiles brought into the land, and they intermarried with the Gentiles brought into the land, and they were lost forever. That's not how it happened at all. The Samaritans were purebred. They were a close-knit group with minimal intermarriage. Who remained loyal to Moses and the one true God of Israel. Now, they were wrong in some details, like worshiping at Mount Gerizim instead of Jerusalem, making their own temple instead of relying on the temple in Jerusalem. They made it throwing away a good part of the Old Testament, that kind of thing. But they were devoted to Moses, and they were devoted to worship of the one true God, even if they weren't fully associated with the true worship of him. They considered themselves pure Israelites, descendants of Abraham. Now let's go back to John 4. John 4, we'll pick it up here in our account. Look how all, now with this little bit of a background, when he's talking about these people and these places and things, I think it's important that things will begin to fall in place. This isn't a group of Samaritans who are half-breed, idol-worshipping, know-nothings, that are just cast away. These are Samaritans. They're very loyal to Moses. They're not idolatrous. They're worshiping, in their own way at least, the one true God of Israel. They revere the fathers of Israel. Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, especially through the line of Manasseh. Remember, we saw that earlier. And those Israelites left behind in the Assyrian captivity. They consider themselves to be the descendants in the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They consider themselves to be the descendants of the faithful, believing remnant left behind after the Assyrian captivity. And they remained a small-knit, close group that, as far as it was possible, didn't intermarry with the Gentiles. They stayed pure line. So they considered themselves to be of the descendants of Abraham. Look at verse 4 of John 4. And you'll see now all these things are going to start kicking in here. Look at verse 4. And this is Jesus. Now he must needs go through Samaria. Then comes he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of land that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. See, that's what they go back to. They go back to the patriarchs. They go back to Jacob. They go back to Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his son Joseph. And they particularly believe when the Assyrians carried off the bulk of the northern kingdom, the bulk of Samaria, the idolatrous Israelites, idolatrous Israelite Samaritans, the ones that were left in the land was that believing remnant loyal to God. They were outcast and persecuted because they didn't participate in the nation's idolatry. And they thought that they were especially through that group was especially associated with Joseph and Manasseh, the tribe of Joseph, which was the tribe of Manasseh there. That's what they consider themselves the descendant of, the pure descendants of that since the Assyrian captivity. In fact, they considered themselves a sect of Judaism, although being divorced from the house of Israel, they divorce themselves from the house of Israel. We'll look at this in a minute. But they considered themselves a true sect of Judaism, relying on Moses, devoted to Moses and his five books, the law, and worship the one true God. And so that's who this woman is a group with. And you're going to see now, as with that understanding, if we throw away some of the traditional ways this is taught and have this little more basic historical understanding, a lot of the conversation here, I think, is going to open up. All right. So with this background in place, we get to a woman in Samaria at Jacob's. And she considers Jacob her father, those fathers of Israel, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Manasseh. She considers herself, and she says here in verse 6, it brings us to the point. So he's traveling, and he says in verse 6, John 4, verse 6, "Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was the sixth hour." And we went through some of the details of that last time. "There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, Give me to drink." So here he were being brought. We'll get into some of the drama of the scene next week. Here I just want to bring out, she's going to Jacob's well. And she's, remember the history of this now, Jacob was renamed Israel. Remember when he wrestled with the man who turned out to be the Lord, and the Lord incapacitated him, broke a tendon or whatever in his leg, so he couldn't wrestle anymore. And we'll take a look at that in a minute. But that became then the name of the northern kingdom, Israel. Once they divided, that was typically the name used for the northern kingdom. Judah would have been used, or Jerusalem would have been used for the southern kingdom. So let's go take a look at that account. Genesis 32, verse 38. I guess we need to bring up a little, let's begin at verse 24. "And Jacob was left alone." Remember, I guess I should give a little more background in case we're not, just to give a little more of the, with the context. I remember Jacob, he left the land. Remember, he deceived Isaac into giving him the blessing of Esau. Esau gets mad and he tells Rebekah, the mother, "I'm going to kill Jacob." Rebekah says, "Better get out of town, Jacob. Why don't you go to Uncle Laban in Haran?" And so he goes off to Uncle Laban. Of course, Uncle Laban turned out to be even trickier than Jacob. But now he's on the way back. He was with Laban. Remember, he got married, has a bunch of kids, has all this stuff. Now he's coming back to the land. And he's right at the point of entering the land, the promised land. And that's where this occurs. He's afraid of Esau. He's afraid Esau's going to come now holding this grudge and is going to not only kill him, but kill his family as well. So that's the background. And now he's left alone, verse 24. "And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw," so they wrestle all night long, kind of like what Jacob's been doing with the law through this whole journey. This kind of a picture of that. He wrestles all night long. And when, verse 25, "and when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him." So he incapacitates Jacob. He wrestled with him all night long. And Jacob still wouldn't leave it. Was still going to do it his own way, was still going to keep wrestling. So the Lord had to finally come and just incapacitate him. The man had to just incapacitate him. He pulled something out of a socket or something, so he couldn't do anything. He was incapacitated. Why didn't the man just do that the night before and save all this wrestling? Well, it's because this wrestling is the point of the story. It's a picture of Israel's history. We won't pull it up there, but that chart we just had, the courses of punishment, that's what the courses of punishment are supposed to do. They're supposed to, well, maybe we should pull it back up. Let's just, so you can see it. in better picture form. The courses of punishment, that's what the Lord is wrestling with Israel. Just like he's wrestling with Jacob here. He's wrestling with the nation of Israel over, and he's wrestling and wrestling and wrestling and wrestling. And they still keep fighting. They still refuse to rely on him. They still refuse to come to him and have him do everything for them. They still refuse to call on him to do what needs to be done. And he's wrestling and he's wrestling and he's wrestling. And that's especially what this tribulation period is going to do. It's going to bring Israel to the very brink. And it's going to incapacitate them. It's going to pull their joint out of the socket. It's going to incapacitate them. So they have no other option but just to fall on the Lord Jesus Christ. Fall, what I say, fall on the grace resident in his Jehovah name, where he dispenses grace to Israel. That I am Jehovah name, which we're going to run into Jesus using of himself in the account, the first time in the account of the Samaritan woman. He's taking them through all this courses of punishment is just to get them to stop wrestling and just fall on the grace resident. Let him do everything for them. Just, I am blank space. Just tell me what you need me to do and I'll do it. That's the only way Israel's going to be God's holy nation and a kingdom of priests. And what is happening with Jacob here in Genesis 32 is a picture of what the Lord is doing with the whole nation of Israel through these courses of punishment. He's taking to the point where till they're incapacitated, so they have to just rely on him. That's their only hope as they go through here. That's the purpose of those five courses. And so the Lord here has incapacitated the heel catcher. Let's go back to the Genesis account. We'll go back. Hopefully I don't need to go refer to that again. All right. Oops. There we go. And so now let's go back to the account in Genesis 32. Verse 20, let's pick it up, verse 26. So he's incapacitated Jacob, and now finally Jacob says, and he said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, this is Jacob, I will not let thee go except thou bless me. Now Jacob's doing what Israel's supposed to do. Just ask God for a blessing. Ask the Lord for a blessing. And he's been incapacitated. He has no other option. He has to just fall on the grace of this man here, but we're going to find out it's really the Lord. And he's going to say here, and verse 27, he's learned his lesson as he said, and he said unto Jacob, he, the man, said unto Jacob, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. You know what the name Jacob means? It means heel catcher. It means deceiver. Jacob has been going through his whole life figuring how to get things for himself through his own power and flesh and wit and deceptions. He out-deceived Isaac and Esau. He out-deceived, in the end anyway, Laban. He's out-deceiving everyone, getting his stuff, doing it his own way, getting it. And now he's been incapacitated. The heel catcher, the deceiver's been incapacitated. Now he's doing what he's supposed to do. Give me a blessing. I can't do it on my own. You're going to have to give it to me. And here, right when he's ready to change his name, right at this point, God makes him say his own name, Jacob, the deceiver. And now he's going to give him a new name. And he said, verse 28, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. Israel means the prince of God. Actually, let's read the rest of the verse. But Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. Once he became incapacitated. Now, you see, this is the way God works. We think we have to be powerful to carry out God's work. See, that's the big mistake of Jacob here and the nation of Israel. No, that's the whole wrong way of going about it. You have to be incapacitated. You have to be weak so that you have no other option but to rely on the Lord. That's the only way Israel's going to become the nation he designed her to be. That's the only way us and the mystery and the dispensation of grace is going to be the people he designed us to be. And so he takes him to this point. Your name's not going to be Jacob. You're going to be Israel, Prince of God. Some suggest that this actually translates into God fights, which the idea there is God fights for Israel. And that fits into that I am Jehovah name, right? One of the compound names is I am your conquering hero. I will fight. I will defeat your enemies. I will fight for you, that I am name. Now, verse 29. And so he asked him what his name was. Now Jacob asked him, tell me, I pray thee, what's your name? What's thy name? And he said, wherefore is it that thou dost ask me my name? Now that sounds kind of weird, right? Why doesn't he tell him his name? Well, the reason he doesn't tell him his name is because he's indicating to Jacob ought, well, I guess Israel now, Jacob/Israel ought to have known his name. This isn't the first time he's run into the Lord. This isn't the first time he's encountered the Lord. This is when he's returning to the land. But when he came out of the land, just before he's ready to leave the land of Israel to go to Uncle Laban, right before he leaves the land, God encountered him, the Lord encountered him the first time. So let's go look at that. Flip back a couple pages. Flip back to chapter 28. Chapter 28. Here we are at Bethel. This is, he thinks Esau's chasing him. He's just deceived Isaac, Esau, stole Esau's birthright, all that stuff. Now he's leaving the land, running to get out of the land before Esau catches up with him. Just before he leaves the land here at Bethel, he's going to have a vision. So we'll pick up the vision. We all know this vision. We've read about this vision already in the book, in the Gospel of John, the end of John 1, the stairway to heaven concept. And here we have the dream, verse 12. Genesis 28, verse 12. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending. And behold, the Lord, notice that's all caps, that the I am Jehovah God of Israel. He's standing at the top of the stairs there. And what's he do? He talks to Jacob. Jacob should know his voice. Jacob should know who his name. It's the Lord. He should know this. And he says, I am the Lord. The I am Jehovah God of Israel. And here the God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. And then he says, the land wherein thou liest, I will give it to thee and thy seed. And he reconfirms the promises he made to Abraham and Isaac. And now he reconfirms them, all those promises on behalf of the nation of Israel to Jacob. The point here is that Jacob shouldn't need to ask his name. He should know his name because he's encountered him when he left the land. Now he's encountering him again when he enters the land. Go back to Genesis 32. And let's see how this all fits. Remember, he identifies at Bethel with the ladder into the heavens. And behold, the Lord stood in it and said, I am the Lord God. Now go back to Genesis 32. Genesis 32. And let's pick it up here. First, let's read 29 again. And Jacob answered him. And said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he answered, wherefore is it that thou askest for my name? Jacob, you should have known what my name is. I'm the one who encountered you when you left the land. I'm the one that's going to do everything for you. I'm the Lord, the I am Jehovah God of Israel. And look what he does. The end of verse 29. And he blessed him. First, Jacob had to be incapacitated and fall on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. There is no other option. And the Lord blessed him. And what does he call the place? Verse 30. Jacob should have known. This is the I Am Lord. He should have known this. Verse 30, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And so he puts on display here, this is what he received before he left. He's going to receive, he receives before he returns to the land. All right. So that's the name. So now when we go back to John 4, when you read, they're at Jacob's well. The woman's going to talk about this too. They're at this place where Jacob, her forefather, she considers her forefather, Joseph and Manasseh, and going back to Jacob and going back to Abraham. That's where she's going. She's going to those forefathers there. And the Samaritans of Jesus' day considered themselves Israelites, especially being the descendants of the two northern tribes, Joseph, it's really not, those aren't two tribes. Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and each one of them received a tribe. And so this is a little bit of a typo. The two tribes would be Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribe of Joseph divided in between his two sons. And especially Manasseh, Joseph through the line of Manasseh, and they believed those were the ones that were primarily left in the land because they were disadvantaged, were poor, were persecuted, and the Assyrians carried off the idolatrous Israelite Samaritans of 2 Kings 17 and left behind loyal, faithful Israelites that were of the tribe of Manasseh. They considered themselves the descendants of that, a pure line back to Manasseh through Joseph to Jacob and Abraham. The main distinction that they did was they worshipped at Mount Gerizim. They believed Mount Gerizim was the right place to worship rather than Jerusalem. But they were dedicated to the law of Moses, and they were waiting for Messiah. Now, the woman, look how she brings up all these things. Look at chapter 4, John 4. Look at verse 12. She's going to bring this up herself. Verse 12, art thou greater? She's talking to Jesus, remember? Art thou greater than our father Jacob? She considered her descent, she's a descendant, a part of the Samaritans that are descendants, go all the way back to Jacob and his son Joseph and his son Manasseh, and he's who gave us the well. She talks about Jacob. And you see, when you talk about Jacob, you talk about Joseph, you talk about Isaac, and you talk about Abraham, they don't all have to always be spelled out. She goes back to the patriarchs of Israel. She considers herself a descendant, along with the other Samaritans, of Israel. And look what else she's doing. Look at verse 25. John 4, verse 25. The woman said unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, he which is called Christ, the Messiah Christ. She's waiting for the Messiah and the Christ. She considers herself of the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. She's waiting for the Messiah, the Christ. She's devoted to Moses and the law. That's what the Samaritans are in Jesus' day. Very low, not idolatrous, not half-breeds, not all the stuff that you read about, because people confuse those different referrings to people in Samaria. When it refers to people in Samaria, it doesn't always mean Samaritans. It can just mean, especially when they start showing up on the scene, these are who the Samaritans are. So now let's carry it into the New Testament. While Jesus told his disciples not to go to the Samaritans at large. Let's look at that passage. Go to Matthew. Isn't it interesting? Now, we have to have our time. Let's go to Matthew 10, verse 5. Now, we have to have this in mind. Remember, these first five chapters of John, they fit in the middle of Matthew 4. So what we're reading about with the Samaritan woman happened very early in his earthly ministry. It would be, if you found a place for it in Matthew, it would be in between, in Matthew 4, it'd be in between the temptation of Satan and his trip to Galilee to give the Sermon on the Mount. It'd be between those two things in the middle of Matthew 4, very early in his earthly ministry. Now you get to Matthew 10. So this is after he's dealt with the Samaritan woman, after that account. But look what he tells his disciples. Verse 5. This is Matthew 10, verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the house of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. Well, before this, by many months, he had gone out to, he'd taken them all out to Samaria, and he himself interacted, had an encounter with a Samaritan woman. And at the end of the chapter, he's going to encounter the whole village. But when it comes months later, he's going to tell his disciples not to go to the Samaritans or the Gentiles. And so the question is why? What are they supposed to do? Verse 6, go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. The Samaritans considered themselves true descendants of the patriarchs, a sect of Judaism, but they had divorced themselves from the house of Israel. The house of Israel is centered on the Davidic monarchy, which Jeroboam, way back in the day, rejected and set up that false worship on Gerizim, Mount Gerizim. So they divorced themselves from the house of Israel that's centered on the Davidic monarchy, centered in Jerusalem, and worshiping at the temple in Jerusalem. They went off. They took the patriarchs, and they took the law, and they're still worshiping the one true God, but they do it on Mount Gerizim, and they do it not in accord with what was going on in Jerusalem. So they have this background, but they're divorced from the house of Israel centered in Jerusalem and the temple that's there, and the Davidic monarchy. Now, that's a very important thing to realize, and we're going to expand on this quite a bit, but what's going to have to happen is the two areas of the nation, the Judeans and the Samaritans, are going to be, in order for the whole nation to carry out its purpose, the Judeans and the Samaritans are going to have to be brought back together. And we'll look at that Ezekiel 37 concept a little bit later. And so while this is all true of them, and they consider themselves actually a sect of Judaism, they have divorced themselves from the house of Israel because they've rejected the Davidic monarchy, Jerusalem, and the true place of worship in the temple, and are doing that in a different spot. All right. So let's go to the next one. And sometimes the Samaritans have a negative response. Go to Luke 9. They don't all respond like this village of Samaritans and the woman. Go to Luke 9. Luke 9, verse 51. Luke 9, verse 51. And here, getting... moving along, Jesus is going to return to Jerusalem, verse 51. This is Luke 9, verse 51. And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. So here he is. He's having dealings with the Samaritans. So that will be an interesting thought when we expand on John 4. But the thing I'm trying to bring out here is just the different reactions and responses of Samaritans. Verse 53, and they did not receive him because his face was though was go to Jerusalem. Since he's going to Jerusalem, they reject Jerusalem as the place of worship. They worship on Mount Gerizim. They don't accept him and give him the preparations he was looking for. But look at the rest of this passage, and this will lead us into the reason why Jesus went to Samaria, but forbids his disciples from going to Samaria. Verse 54, "And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, You know not what manner of spirit ye are of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village, another village of Samaritans, and it sounds like the other village would receive them. But this village didn't. Call down lightning and destroy them. But what do we talked a lot about in John? The whole purpose of his earthly ministry is he's now to reverse the order of the law. Yes, fire should have gone down and consumed them. For all the errors, the rejection of Christ, the rejection of Jerusalem, the rejection of the Davidic covenant, the Davidic monarchy, rejection of all that, they should have come down and consumed them. But instead, what is the whole earthly ministry? By the grace resident in his Jehovah name, it changes the order of the law. The law says, go down and consume them, and if anyone's left standing, I'll do something with them. I'll give them more mercy and grace. The grace resident in his Jehovah name switches that. So he goes first in grace and mercy, offers them his grace and mercy. Then depending on how they respond to that will depend on whether they get more grace and mercy or wrath and judgment. And so this is his earthly ministry. He's coming in grace and mercy. He's coming in the long suffering of God to offer repentance and salvation to the nation of Israel. And at this point, he's not consuming. He's still offering his grace and mercy through his name. And so that's what he's doing in this first coming. At the second coming, he's going to return and destroy his enemies. Consume them. Here at his first coming, he's offering grace and mercy. His Jehovah, the grace resident, that Jehovah name, the grace he's dispensing through his name. All right, we can look at a couple other things. Jesus, we won't look up these passages. Better catch up in my slides. We won't look up in these passages, but he was sympathetic to them. John 4, I guess we could look at Luke 10, because we're so close to it. Luke 10. Luke 10, verse 25. And he says here, and behold, a certain lawyer said, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? I think that's the wrong text there. It isn't. Keep going. Go down to verse 30. So the context is this lawyer who asked this question, but look at verse 30. And Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves. And verse 33, and a certain Samaritan. So he's going to give the parable of the good Samaritan. So sometimes they receive him, sometimes he doesn't. They don't. And here Jesus is warm to them. Of course, he's warm to the Samaritan woman at the well and the Samaritans there. He gives a parable about the good Samaritan. And then we'll close by looking at Acts 8. Let's just close it by looking at Acts 8 here. And that brings us to one of the more interesting passages on the Samaritans. Acts 8, and actually the word Samaritans isn't used here, but these are going to be people in Samaria that Philip is going to be witnessing to. This is right after the stoning of Stephen. And he's going to, remember in Acts 7, they stone Stephen, and who shows up on the scene? Well, I guess we could look at that. Go back to chapter 7, verse 58. And so the stoning of Stephen, and they laid down their clothes at a young man's feet whose name was Saul. Verse 1, and Saul, chapter 8, verse 1, was consenting unto his death. And at that time, there was a great persecution against the church that was at Jerusalem, and so forth as you go through that. So there, Jerusalem persists and says, we're not going to receive the Lord Jesus Christ. We refuse to let this man rule over us. And stone Stephen, and Saul comes out as the leader of the persecution against Christ and his people. And now because of that persecution, not because Jerusalem received Christ, but because Jerusalem rejected Christ, the disciples are chased out of the Jerusalem area and they go up into Samaria. And what happens there? They were, verse 4, they were scattered abroad, went everywhere preaching the word. Then Philip went down to the city of Samaria and preached Christ unto them. And the people with one accord gave heed to those things which he spoke, and seeing the miracles that he did, and again, that's signs, for unclean spirits crying with loud voice, and so forth. We don't need to go through the whole passage. The point is, Philip is going to go and preach to the people of Samaria. Now, there was Gentiles in Samaria. There were Jews in Samaria. There were the Samaritans were in Samaria at this time. And who was he talking to? And we know it wasn't the Gentiles, because if you flip over to Acts 11, verse 19. Now remember what just happened here, the stoning of Stephen and persecution because Israel rejected Christ that pushed these disciples out of Jerusalem and Judea into Samaria. And now look what it says in chapter 11, which is many years later. My reference Bible has 34 in chapter 8 and 41 in chapter 11. So that would be 7 years. 7 years. And look how it summarizes this in verse 19. This is Acts 11, verse 19. Now they which were scattered abroad upon the persecution that arose about Stephen, that's what we just talked about in Acts 8, traveled as far as Phenice, Cyprus, and Antioch, preaching the word to none but unto the Jews only. So when they were scattered out of Jerusalem and Judea and they went up into Samaria, it says at that point, everything all the way to chapter 11, all they ministered to was the Jews. Now that tells us a couple things, that then they were witnessing, preaching to the Jews, Jewish Jews who were Samaritans. They considered them, remember, the Samaritans considered themselves a Jewish, Judean sect. And they went up to preach to them only to the Jews. So here you see again, the Samaritans, they were considered a part of the Jewish heritage. They were considered to come from the same patriarchs, the same line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Manasseh. They came out of the faithful, believing remnant that was left behind in the Assyrian captivity. They were trampled underfoot by the Assyrians, or by the Gentiles the Assyrians brought in to rule the land on behalf of the Assyrians. But they stayed a united, close-knit group through all that trial, all that tribulation, and they managed to grow and become prosperous enough in 400 BC to build their own temple. And then they become more and more on the scene. They develop their own set of scriptures based on the Mosaic law. Now we're in the days of Jesus. That's the Samaritans. That's who he's going to be dealing with. They considered themselves to be part of that Jewish Israelite line. All right, let's go ahead and close there, and we'll pick it up with Jesus must needs go through Samaria, and we'll see why he must needs go through Samaria. That's where we'll pick it up next time. Let's close with a word of prayer.